If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
It isn't just about the grapes. It isn't just about the land. If you don't have good people that you're working with, you don't have any of that.
We're better now today with more friendly competition. The wine community bands together when anything happens in our universe, agriculturally, fires, whatever, we're there for each other. And I feel the farming community needs each other, and we need to compete with each other in a positive fashion. I think that's been good for building up Napa Valley.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 493. This week we feature Brian Maloney, winemaker at Buena Vista Winery in Napa and Sonoma. The history of Napa Valley and Sonoma may be surprising to those that take the time to read up on the past. The colorful characters of history almost seem to be reborn in modern-day winemaking. Buena Vista Winery is like a living character with a long history of wine in California. Brian Maloney is winemaker at Buena Vista, and this is our second interview with him, the first being back in January of 2018, podcast number 258. History is in this wine. And wine is passion. You can also hear Brian on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term bunghole. Back in Napa Valley, once again with our friend Brian Maloney, winemaker at Buena Vista. How you doing, Brian?
Good, Ray. How are you?
Real good. Good to see you again, sir.
Thank you. Great to have you back out.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. And ironically, today, we are, instead of being at Buena Vista, we are at Raymond over in Napa Valley, as I say.
Yes, we are on the other side of the hill. It's an area now that Buena Vista has, recolonized after a departure for a bit and reestablished itself as one of the key players in the Napa Valley as well.
Of course, this is part of... Let me go back here. That, of course, this is all part of the JCB collection, Jean-Charles Boisset, and that would be Raymond and Buena Vista and Deloche and, of course, his kingdom over in France. He's definitely a wine guy.
Oh, at his core. I mean, he was born in it, raised in it, literally in the cellars of his family in Vougeot. And I've had the great pleasure of working with him since I was a young winemaker out of UC Davis. Had started my first harvest with the Deloche family at Deloche Vineyards. And then his family made their first winery purchase in California of Deloche. And so got to know him early on, really in that kind of Pinot Noir-centric land of the Russian River Valley. But, you know, after a few years of kind of, I guess, getting comfortable in the area, he branched out with the purchase of Raymond Vineyards. And then really, in a lot of ways, I think the winery that's kind of knitted everything together has been Buena Vista. And that's a lot of it has to do with its location and its history. This, you know, prominent winery right on the edge of both Sonoma as well as Napa, historically owning properties on both sides of the hill, and also a winery that has a over 100 years of history of making both these classic kind of Burgundian cool climate style wines, you know, Chardonnays, Pinot Noirs, but also Cabernet Sauvignon, Sauvignon Blanc, and these warmer climates. And I think that comes from Augustin Hrasti, the founder, the Count of Buena Vista's vision at that time, that exploration. But also, when you look at this incredible place that Buena Vista was started at, it is it's a location that in a very short distance you shift from exploring and being in a very cool climate, that kind of Carneros, windswept area, to just over a ridgeline, all of a sudden you're in a quite warm pocket with different soils that much more suited to those Bordeaux varieties.
And the Count is still around. I understand he wanders the halls from time to time.
We have stories of ghosts, but then we also have the stories of the Count himself. We have a fantastic gentleman who has brought back that history with an incredible amount of diligence in terms of the historical research going into the Count, but as well as portraying the energy and the enthusiasm that he brought to California and to Sonoma.
It is interesting because I have heard these stories of it being spirited. We'll leave it with that rather than another word. But you go to Buena Vista, and because of its age, being the oldest winery in California, you just feel the vibe. It's a place you got to see because it's so cool.
Yeah, it is. There's very few places in the United States, I would say, that really have that energy. It's something that when you walk down the path into Buena Vista, you have to detach yourself. You're not driving up to it in a car. You're walking a path, and you're coming down into this little hidden valley against a hillside with these magnificent stone buildings. And then when you do walk into those buildings, there's an energy. You feel the thousands of hands that went into crafting the Buena Vista winery. And I mean hands, because it is hand-carved out of the mountainside right where you're at. It's something that I'm a big believer that you have the energy of the people before you in the surroundings of where you are, and that energy lasts forever, and it never goes away. And you see it in the pick marks, but you also see it in just the intelligence of the design of that site, how it's oriented against that hillside, how those caves are carved into the hillside so that they are constantly cool. Even when we have these blazing hot days in Sonoma County where it's 100 degrees outside, in the caves of Buena Vista, you're at 55. And that says a lot to the forethought of the people like the Count Agustin Horasti when he built this site and when he commissioned these caves to be dug. It wasn't for a 10 or 15 year program. This was for generations, and I am incredibly proud to be part of that legacy, holding on and keeping it going forward. Which, of course, you know, it really came down to John Charles and his family investing into that, because when we purchased Buena Vista in 2011, that energy in a lot of ways wasn't there. It was very much imprisoned, for lack of a better word. It had been condemned. The bigger the two buildings, the larger the two buildings.
I didn't know that.
Had been condemned after the 89 earthquake. So it was shut. It was covered in ivy. There was cyclone fencing and asphalt. Almost the exact opposite energy that you feel now. You felt like you were looking at, someone wasting away, and waiting for that last, for lack of a better word, earthquake or what have you to collapse the buildings. And we came in, and his vision from day one was to reopen it to wine, to bring back winemaking, to bring back visitors, to bring back life to it. And it was a major endeavor. I mean, we're talking about every single stone of that building essentially needing to be reset. So all of the mortar, all of the grout holding it together to be chipped away. The building itself was given a new steel skeleton. So internal to all those stones is now a steel skeleton that holds it together. And then they were all remortared back to that steel skeleton. And so when we had the 2014 Napa earthquake, quite a powerful earthquake, kind of gets overshadowed by Loma Prieta and things like that. But this was an earthquake that literally shifted the Mayacama Mountains 18 inches.
Wow.
There was a massive gaping slash in Highway 12 as you drive between Napa and Sonoma, where the earth itself literally rotated to the north and to the west as it was pulled away. So just massive, massive force of energy shifted the mountain that Buena Vista is built into. And if we had not done that restoration, if we hadn't had the foresight to make sure this building was preserved for, you know, at least the next 100 years, if not beyond, it would have been rubble. You would have been having just, you know, a collapse. And instead you have this magnificent, beautiful building, this, you know, the white stones just going skyward. And so there's so many special things about that site. And the rededication of it was a magnificent day. It corresponded with the 200th anniversary of the Count's birthday. We were able to also sign the documents that made Sonoma and Tokai, the village where the Count's family originally came from, sister cities on that day. And really, it was, to me, it was topped off by Charles Sullivan's speech that day, where he got in front. Charles Sullivan, of course, a famous wine author, wrote many books about Napa and Sonoma. And he really focused on Buena Vista that day and the buildings themselves, and talking about the fact that this was America's chateau. This was the place where wine really started in America in a serious fashion. Of course, wine had been made all the way back to, you know, the revolutionary times in Virginia, but it had never reached the pinnacle that it would in California until those first vines were planted by Horasti. Those classic European grapevines were put in the ground. The techniques that were present in Europe at that point in time were practiced in California and then spread. I mean, this is a man who, in many ways was a progenitor of winemaking in the Napa Valley, with his friendship and partnership with Charles Krug, all the way into Charles Krug bringing over his very first press from Buena Vista before he made the first wines in the Napa Valley.
Interestingly enough, though, that you talk about this whole idea of survival, and yet when you and I last met, you remember that fire that came down the hillside, and I looked at it after we talked, was frightening as heck. The winery really got very lucky.
Without a doubt. We have to say thank you to our firefighters and to all our first responders, because without them, again, Buena Vista would have met disaster. The 2017 fire literally came down to the stones of the building.
Yeah.
I have a good friend who's a firefighter who sent me videos of the fire trucks literally parked all up and down the road to Buena Vista, the pathway to Buena Vista, as they fought that fire coming down from the Mayacamas. And it is amazing to think of the amount of energy that was put. And, looking back at it, it was because this was where they were going to make a stand to save Sonoma.
Sure, right.
It was a good spot for them to make that stand. But you have to feel that, again, that energy was there, that forethought was there, and everyone was behind wanting to save this legacy of California. And yeah, we were very lucky in 2017 to see that happen.
And it's a residential area too, right around there. You're not far from the square in Sonoma, so there was a lot going on there.
Literally, you're about a mile and a half from the square in Sonoma. If it had come down and passed Buena Vista, it would have moved into the creeks. And that's, as we now know, after too many fires, that is the biggest danger. When these fires come down into the creeks, they race. That dry brush, you can't stop it. And so they made their stand and they were successful. And so if you come to Buena Vista today, you won't notice as you would when you were last visiting us, because there's been that just phenomenal regrowth that happens after fire. I mean, fire is part of our landscape. We need to embrace it at a certain level.
Right.
But it was the first day I got back there when you could still smell the ash in the air. It was a devastating sight to see. And the landscape has changed forever. But that's okay, because we still have those stones and we still have this beautiful little valley to celebrate.
Oh, it's great. Everything turned out at the time well. Let's hope to the future things will be good. But we'll not talk much more about that, shall we? Something interesting for me I've noticed, and I'm trying to remember if it was the barrel auction or if it was the auction Napa Valley, where Buena Vista had wines that were offered there. And traditionally, of course, they're usually Napa wines. So you have an intermarriage. Obviously, we have Jean-Charles behind this. But how did that happen?
Well, from the start, I would say with Buena Vista, our vision was reuniting the Napa and Sonoma sides of Buena Vista. Buena Vista, historically, going back to 1857 all the way through 2005, owned properties on both sides of the Mayacamas. That has been its history. You are both a Napa and a Sonoma winery. Where the property is located is just a few hundred yards away from that Napa and Sonoma County line. So I think that's an important piece to start with, is that this is its history. It's arguable that Herassi was the first person to grow grapes in Napa County for commercial purposes up in Level Valley. So that history is there. And in 2011, when we purchased it, Buena Vista had, over the generations, been kind of severed down to just a very small piece of property. And so we have endeavored to expand back again. And in 2016, we purchased a historic site here in St. Helena, actually, and only a couple miles away, a ranch we call the Founders Ranch in honor of the Herassi and his role as the founder, really, of California viticulture. And with that purchase of an estate vineyard, we really wanted to make a statement about being back in the Napa Valley. And so both the premier Napa Valley auction as well as Auction Napa Valley seemed like the place to do that. And so we made our auction lots, and then have been able to garner a little bit of attention for it. But really, the one this past year really kind of, I think, claimed quite a bit of attention has been our collaboration with the Charles Krug Winery.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but go ahead, you beat me to it.
Yeah. So Charles Krug and Augustin Herassi came to California at a similar time. At that point in time, you have to understand that there was a lot of kind of German-influenced immigrants coming into California. And even though Herassi was Hungarian by birth, obviously he was part of this, of a German empire, the Habsburg-Austrian Empire at that point in time. And he got to know this other German immigrant, Charles Krug, who was a Prussian. They were both in San Francisco at the same time. And Augustin actually hired him to work at the Mint in San Francisco when he was the chief assayer of the San Francisco Mint, prior to Buena Vista. Now, that that led to indictments and, you know, accusations of embezzlement. So Herassi, of course, had to, you know, depart under a little bit of a cloud. He's since multiple times been absolved. We're now 100% sure he didn't embezzle that money. So that's good to know.
That's good.
But when he came up to Buena Vista and had established the winery here, he hired Charles Krug to come help him run it. And this was Charles's opportunity to really learn the wine industry from someone who comes from a family that had been making wine back in Hungary for generations. And after a couple vintages, he then purchased a property up here in Santa Elena and established the very first winery in Napa County. And so you have Charles Krug, the first winemaker in Napa, and Agustin Herassi, arguably the first premium winemaker in all of California. And a few months back, well, a little bit more than that now, but John Charles and the Mondavi family got together and they were discussing, you know, this shared history. And the idea came upon them to, well, what if we collaborate for an auction lot? What if we celebrate this history and this connection? And so I got together with Angelina Mondavi, and we started working with wines from our estate vineyard in Santa Elena. So some Cabernet Franc and some Cabernet Sauvignon, and she brought in some selections from their Yountville properties, a little bit of Petit Verdot and some Cabernet Sauvignon. And together we made a collaboration lot, which ended up being one of the top five grossing lots at this year's premiere. So we were incredibly excited about that. Not only that, but the wine was absolutely delicious, which was even better. And working with Angelina, you know, we've gotten to taste quite a bit together, work on blends together, and we have a similar palate. So it's been a great experience and a great time working with her.
That's nice. That's very cool. Exciting for a winemaker to get into something like that historically as well as contemporarily.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Chateau Buena Vista. I'm just going to leave that to you.
Well, it's become a big thing. So Chateau Buena Vista, as I mentioned earlier, it was really coined with, I think, Charles Sullivan's speech the morning of August 30th, 2012, if I remember correctly. So the Count's 200th birthday, we have all these speeches. He has his speech. He coins the term Chateau Buena Vista, and it just kind of lights a fire. And so we're talking with John Charles and Ken Hornline, our vice president of sales, and myself and Tom Blackwood, who's the general manager of Buena Vista, about, you know, we really want to make a wine that celebrates these buildings and celebrates Buena Vista's place. And so the decision's made, well, let's buy a little bit of fruit this year. In 2012, we'll buy some Napa Cab, and it'll just be for the tasting room. And so we made a very small cuvee. Ended up being about 4 tons of fruit, so about 200 cases that we made of a 2012 Napa Valley Cabernet, and it sold out in that tasting room immediately. I mean, it was one of those like releases and gone.
That's not surprising.
Yeah. So great, right? Very exciting. Well, let's repeat. Let's do a 2013, and this time we decided we'll make enough for some wholesale sales, and so we did. Again, it was the type of thing where as soon as it shows up into the marketplace, people are loving this bottle, they're loving this story, they're loving this wine. And we've seen tremendous success about that Chateau Cabernet. In fact, today with the 2019 vintage, which we're in the process of bottling, and we're dealing with all the supply chain issues that everyone is these days.
Can't even imagine.
We're going to be producing upwards of 40,000 cases of that wine, coming from our own estate vineyards as well as partner sites that we work with up and down the Napa Valley, from Calistoga all the way down into Oak Knoll. So it's become a tremendous success for us. And because of that, we wanted to celebrate that chateau in another way, and that's with opening a new tasting lounge in the town of Napa. So it's a distinct experience, different than what you will have at the historic cellars in Sonoma. This is in the historic Gordon Building, which is this beautiful, I'm going to call it Art Deco. I'm not an artist. John Charles will probably correct me later once he sees this. But a beautiful building, very much, you know, high polish. And just you look at the exterior of this site and you want to go into the building. And then you go in and John Charles has really had his touch. It celebrates a period of time of, you know, that just ethereal but still beautiful elements that you have. So lots of marble, lots of just beautiful things. I can't describe it quite well enough. I was just in there this weekend. You have a tremendous lounge with lots of turquoises and blues and just, you know, the same velvety feel you see here in
sure,
the Red Room.
Absolutely.
But it's its own Buena Vista place. And there we celebrate the wines of Chateau Buena Vista. So the Napa Valley in particular is our focus. With our expansion throughout Napa, we've partnered with several different vineyards throughout the different districts. And so we have Rutherford Appellated Cabernet Sauvignon, Diamond Mountain Cabernet Sauvignon. We have an absolutely exquisite St. Helena Cabernet Franc coming from our Bartolucci Ranch. I think everyone should get a chance to try that. That is one of my favorite wines right now that we're pouring. There's nothing like a great Cabernet Franc, I think. It's just got that voluptuous soft feel and
agreed,
aromatics. And more. We've really had a chance to, I've had a chance as a winemaker to explore these appellations and develop what I feel are the styles of them. I come from a background of Pinot Noir. That's where I cut my teeth, so to speak. And so, you know, with Pinot Noir, it's so easy in a way to have the site express itself. It's kind of you step back, you let a fermentation happen, and it shows. But that's Pinot Noir for you. Cabernet, to me, tends to behave a little bit more like Chardonnay, where it is influenced a lot by the winemaker. And so it takes a little bit more knowledge of that soil type, of that climactic influence, to really peek out what that side is showing. So whether it's Rutherford, where you're trying to really show these tannins and their intensity and their density and their length, versus St. Helena, which is maybe a bit softer and a bit richer, you need to really have a handle on where those grapes are coming from. And that has been my pleasure over the last few years. I'm glad this wasn't something I was tasked with early on. I'm glad it was something after working with several different sites throughout the Napa Valley. In making one single blend, I was allowed to then pursue these different district bottlings, and we've had some great reception to them, and really excited about what's going on down at the Chateau.
Great opportunity for a winemaker to be able to do these kind of things. And recently, Jean-Charles purchased one of my favorite wineries in Napa Valley, which I first discovered, one of our first interviews, in fact, for Life Between the Vines, and that is Elizabeth Spencer, just over in Rutherford. And man, that was like amazing, because they make such a great variety. They source from so many different places.
Yeah. What I've loved about Elizabeth Spencer is this kind of fresh take on appellations. So often we see people get, you know, we're just going to do this narrow little swath, right? We're going to be Napa Valley and that's all we're going to do. And Spencer and Elizabeth many years ago decided, well, we want to pursue grapes in other places, especially Mendocino County, which I have an affinity for. I have some great friends up there. I've worked with some fantastic sites up there. It just seems it's a little too far for many people to get to, which is too bad because it's a beautiful place.
It's a stunning place.
And phenomenal wines.
Yeah.
And so the Sauvignon Blanc that they're working with up there, the Grenache, and then, you know, I have to have a little bit of a soft spot for someone working with some Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir.
Sure.
And Sarah is doing a fantastic job with those wines. The location itself is second to none. I mean, you have this... Yeah, I tend to think that Jean-Charles fell in love with it because it was another historic post office. You know, it was another historic site that he could
sure.
Bring into the fold, so to speak. But it is a phenomenal location right in the middle of Rutherford, and a great selection of wines. I know that Sarah has some great sourcing up in Mount Veeder. I've gotten to taste some of those wines. And I think there's something pretty special that's going to be coming down the line with what they're doing with the Rutherford appellation as well. I know Jean-Charles is incredibly bullish on Rutherford in general.
Yes.
And I think Elizabeth Spencer will be the place where you will see that kind of reach its zenith, so to speak.
That's very cool. To me, one of the most fascinating, I don't like the word occupation, but I'll use it, on this planet is being a winemaker, because you are dealing with so many different things. When you're in the wine business, you're dealing with retail, wholesale, being a manager. You have a production job. There's a lot going on. You as a winemaker, is there a point where the challenges become a little overwhelming? I'm sure harvest could be that way. Your eyes bugged out when I said
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I that's a great question. And I mean, you know, the honest answer is, of course. I mean, there comes those times where, you know, the pressures of everything. We've had some hard years in the past 5 years. I mean, we all have everywhere. But, you know, in Sonoma in particular, 2020 was incredibly tough between what we were dealing with pandemic restrictions, what we were dealing with fires surrounding us, and what we were dealing with what had been a horrible set in terms of just we had late season frost and a really small crop. And so you're faced with all these challenges on top of each other, and it can get you down. But what I've found is that when that happens, I need to look at the people around me, the people I'm working with, the vineyards I'm working with, the vineyard owners I'm working with. And if you've established that connection, when you have that human connection with them, you can reach out to each other. You can work with each other. You can stand there. I remember standing there with Charlie Heintz, who we've been working with for 10 plus years. And I call it the day without a sun, because literally we had this day in harvest of 2020 where we didn't see the sun. It never got darker than like twilight all day long because of the smoke cover. And we're out there and we are talking about, what are we going to do with this harvest? You know, what are we going to do with it? And we're both facing the same situation. We're both out there dealing with crews that we want to make sure stay healthy. We're dealing with smoke that we don't know how it's going to affect the grapes and the wines that are going to come with it. And we just started laughing because there was nothing else we could do, you know? And, you know, so you sit out there and you bullshit for, you know, 20 minutes. And at the end of the day, we're going to move forward and we're going to be friends and we're going to do what we can to make a delicious wine. And you know what? 2020 was hard, but we made some delicious wines. And, you know, I know we're talking about Buena Vista, but I got to talk about my Deloche Russian River Pinot Noir that we made from 2020 because it was an absolute hard wine to make. It was a heartbreaking wine to make because we were out there having to talk with growers about how we can't pick the grapes because of smoke. And that's not a conversation you want to have. And you have people who don't have insurance. And so what are we going to do about that? And so you know what? We worked a way to figure out how we could at least get them something to get them through the year because, man, it's tough when you don't have that resource of your crop coming in. And what we ended up doing, we had to be brutal out there. We had to make hard selections. We had to make hard decisions on both sides. We had to bring in fruit that we weren't sure about. We didn't know where it was going to go. And we had to change how we made wine. We had to go out there in these fermentations, and instead of letting it sit on its skins for 14 to 20 days, it was 10 days. We got to take it off. We're starting to see the bitterness come out. But you know what's come out is we have a wine that I'm proud of and I enjoy, and it's a delicious wine. And our Russian River Pinot Noir is one that I have no regrets about because I think we put from the grower all the way through the winemaker, through the guys in the cellar, we put all our energy into making that a phenomenal wine, and it is. And I enjoyed a bottle of it the other night, and it stands up there with, I think, some of the best Pinot Noirs I've made. And maybe it's because we were faced with all the tough, hard decisions to make, and because we had all that stress that we just, you know, we were able to squeeze a little bit of coal into diamonds, so to speak. So I'm really proud of that wine, and I'm really proud to have the people I work with around me to rely on. Because sometimes we're not going to have those great days. But if you got great people who you trust, that trust you, it works out. It works out.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great. Very exciting to hear you know, again, the passion coming out about that, the whole idea of dealing with this this terror more than, can't really think of a better word than that. For you, do you have a mentor or mentors?
Several. You know, it's interesting that you asked that question because I just got to go on a little trip with the winemaker who hired me at Deloche Vineyards, and his name's Dan Cederquist. He's not the David Ramey of the world in terms of like his name publicity. I mean, David's someone who I've got to work with as well, and he's definitely someone who I think of as a mentor, along with Greg LaFollette,
great guy,
Dan Goldfield. But Dan Cederquist was. Started out as an assistant winemaker at Deloche, became the winemaker, and he brought me on. And, you know, looking back at it, I have to say I am so happy he is the one who brought me on and is the first winemaker I had an experience with. because he's a fairly humble guy. He's proud of what he does, but he's not someone out there, you know, touting his own horn and everything. He's about working with solid fruit and doing what he can to make sure that he's respecting that site and the people around it. And this was the first time I'd really had a chance to hang out with Dan in over a decade. And we were on this trip, and, you know, it was about talking about the folks, you know, that we worked with 15, almost 20 years ago now, and asking how they're doing and where they're at right now. It wasn't about, you know, oh, what are you doing with Pinot Noir or Chardonnay or Cabernet? It was, how are the people? And, you know, we did talk about wines and talk about vineyards that we've worked with together. But it was so much more about just, you know, establishing that this is a person-based process. It isn't just about the grapes. It isn't just about the land. If you don't have good people that you're working with, you don't have any of that. I you know, remember many years ago at Davis, we had a talk about terroir and talking about terroir and what is terroir. And, you know, having this was an American winemaker asking, he was in a cellar in the south of France or in the Rhone Valley asking about what is terroir, and having the vigneron explain it to him. And, you know, they're asking, well, is it, you know, what would you say the percentages? Is it, you know, climate versus soil? Is it, you know, how does it come in? And he's trying to get across. And what ended up coming across in this talk was it's not just one thing. It's not just a place, which is what that word means. It's the entire energy around that place. And it is encapsulated as well with the people doing that work. And if you aren't part of that, then there is no terroir. You don't have these terroirs that stay static across years. They change, they evolve, and they do that with the people. And I think you'll find that all the great terroirs you have in the world, when you really get down to it, there's great passionate people behind those terroirs. Because if there's not, there isn't.
That was a really great answer. That was fabulous. Well, I haven't met very many winemakers that don't have that passion, and certainly many of us who love what we do had somebody that led us there.
Yeah, and you know, I think the reason why you don't meet winemakers who don't have passion is you have to have the passion to get through those mornings and nights.
Yes.
And to get through the pain of walking a block where it's been frost damage and there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, when you have 28 degree weather and the fans aren't powerful enough, or it's an inversion later, you got to look at those grapes and think, well, how can we get these vines through? What are we going to do next year? What is my hope? And people without passion don't have hope. They don't have plans. They move on and become bankers or something else, I guess.
That's a really good phrase. I'm going to steal that from you. There's a line I stole from a winemaker in Finger Lakes, which I thought was really great. You don't meet too many ex-winemakers, do you?
No. Once you're in it, you're bit by it. You know, I think what's interesting is I always talk about, you know, when young people are coming into the industry, I used to think of myself as a young person, but now, you know, I got a couple kids, a little bit more gray hair. But when they come in, there's usually a lot of enthusiasm, I would say, that's involved in winemaking. And their first crush, they're incredibly enthusiastic. But until they've done that full cycle, you don't know if they have passion. Until they've, you know, done that bottling season, until they've seen the life of the wine and made sure they've kept up with watching that wine throughout its entire life, you don't know if they have passion. Enthusiasm lasts for 2 weeks, but enthusiasm usually by November is petered out. And that's when you find out who's got passion and who just likes the thought of wine.
Yeah, that's where there's a change. My favorite question that I ask all winemakers, for the time you've done media and talked to plenty of people with interviews, that sort of thing, what's the one question that you don't get asked that you'd like to be asked?
Oh, man. You know what? This is a great question. I would say, and I'm going to flip it a little bit, because I just had a question pop in my head of, like, what's a question that probably wouldn't get asked, right? And that is, what variety would you not want to work with?
Ooh, that's good.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a little bit different. Most winemakers are like, oh, I'd love to work with Pinot Noir or Cabernet or whatever.
Sure.
And I will be honest that I have had to work with it, but I don't enjoy working with it. And that is Sauvignon Blanc. And that
really?
Is a variety that I find I find challenging. And maybe it's because of my embrace of of kind of this Burgundian reductive winemaking technique, and you know, you kind of sneak in air in certain places. But I am still struggling with Sauvignon Blanc as a winemaker. And I'd love to say I've made a world-class Sauvignon Blanc. I haven't. But it's one that whenever I pick Sauvignon Blanc, I'm always a little hesitant. I don't want to go in the Chardonnay direction. That's kind of like an impulse you have when you see this. And you have, especially Russian River Sauv Blanc, you'll have a lot of like rich flavors. And it's like, I got to restrain myself. But it doesn't react to the same way that Pinot Gris does to stainless steel. So that's the one variety that I always am a little hesitant working with. And I know there's probably some winemaker who's going to watch this and be like, Sauv Blanc's easy. You do this, you know. What a chump. But I don't want to say I'm fearful of working with Sauvignon Blanc, but I don't like working with Sauvignon Blanc.
No, so. That's a very fair answer. Yeah. And I would say that's a very, for lack of a better word, mature answer for somebody who's been around for a while. And you're not afraid to say what you feel about what you've worked with. That's great. Very, very good. My compliments. I'm really glad I was able to reconnect with you, Brian, since it's been a while, and more fun even coming here to Raymond Totally Different, which is cool. I wish you guys great luck with the Buena Vista Chateau, and I thank you for taking the time today.
Thanks, Ray. It's always a pleasure.
Learn more by visiting BuenaVistaWinery.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.